Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, like Aloe or Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret? With Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whatever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/try to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/try.
What's up, Open Floor Globe? I'm your host, Michael the Pod Pina, and I'm joined on the other line by my good friend, Sports Illustrated senior writer Chris Herring, because Rohan Nadkarni lost track of time binging Love Island and will sadly have to hop on later this week instead. Chris, how are you doing today, my friend?
Good. Excited to start a new week and excited to have Game 5 with us pretty soon.
No reaction to Rohan, just really not taking care of his responsibilities with the reality television binge that I referenced at the top, Chris?
Hey, man. Rohan watching reality TV and getting into my Monday, meaning that I got to record on Monday, means that I get my Friday. So we're all good. Long weekend for your boy.
Very fair. Very
potentially.
Fair. Very fair. On today's show, you and I will be analyzing the finals, of course. We'll take a look back to Game 4. We will look ahead to tonight's Game 5, a pivotal game, the most important basketball game of the entire season. But first, a quick reminder to please keep your emails coming, openfloormail@gmail.com. That's openfloormail@gmail.com. Okay, so Chris, let's jump in from the start with a quick conversation about Game 4. The Golden State Warriors won that contest 107-97 inside Boston Garden. Steph Curry was amazing. We are going to talk a lot about Steph Curry today. Boston's offense was very bad in that game, particularly down the stretch in the fourth quarter. Very stagnant offense. Just, you know, big picture view, what was your reaction watching that game? And is there a play or sequence that kind of stands out to you 3 days later? There are obviously so many important possessions, but do any one or two kind of stick in your brain when you think about those 48 minutes?
There, you know, I went back and watched the game a second time this morning, and really, I don't think there was one play. There's maybe one play that I thought was interesting that I doubt a lot of people even remember, where Steph grabs an offensive rebound, I think, in between, was it Smart and Tatum at one point, and then just kind of went back up with it, which I was like, how often do you see that, where Steph is grabbing, you know, offensive
10 rebounds,
getting put back.
Steph Curry.
Super impressive, you know, just like you can't let him hurt you, of all people, off a putback with everything else he's doing. And so just a lapse for the Celtics and just a really heads up play and, you know, him being in the right place at the right time. But really, I thought, you know, aside from that, which was just kind of weird to watch and you know, impressive to see, I just kept thinking about that. It was like the same iteration of the same play every time. There wasn't really one. I mean, you had the crazy one where Steph wanted the 4-point play where Tatum bumps into him. You had another one where Derek White at one point kind of has his hand extended to contest Steph. And after Steph makes a ridiculous shot where he has no space, Derek White just kind of, it was almost like one of those plays like from, you know, that frame from The Office where they just look directly into the camera where it looked like Derek White was doing that, where he's like, what the hell else am I supposed to do? But it was repeatedly Steph kind of having single coverage basically and toasting somebody either with the three or when Robert Williams came up as high as you possibly could to take away his airspace, Steph saying, okay, well, I'm, you know, more nimble than you, and I can just dribble a few feet into the arc and hit a jump shot, you know, mid-range jump shot or a floater, which he did once or twice. So it was just the inability to stop that whenever it happened, and pretty much everything they tried just going awry. The guy was on fire the whole night. And so it wasn't really one player, one sequence. It was just, you know, there have been a couple Groundhog Day moments in this series every time we have a third quarter, obviously, but also Steph getting these looks and really making them count essentially every single time. And that's it's crazy to see it at this high of a level in the finals, but that's just how good he's been.
So Steph played 9 minutes in the fourth quarter of game four. Do you want to guess what Golden State's offensive rating was when he was on the court in that period? Chris, do you enjoy my spontaneous?
No, because I don't like feeling unprepared. I hate it, actually. 135. I'm going to go slightly high, but it's probably too low.
143.8.
I said 135 would be a record by like 17 or 18 points, and it's too low. That's insane. Mm-hmm. That's insane.
And man, Boston's offensive rating in the fourth quarter was 86.4. And after the game and during the practice day, Ime Udoka said, and we'll talk about Steph throughout the episode, I'm sure, but Ime Udoka said that, and reiterated when asked about the defensive coverage on Curry, that if Boston executed offensively, they would have won the game and the series would be at least 3-1, I think was Ime's.
That was what he said.
Quote. Yeah. So the one play that I had, so funny that, you bring up all of the, you know, the up to touch pick and roll coverages that the Celtics had on Steph when he hit just insane shot after insane shot, really difficult stuff. He got loose a couple times off the ball, but it was mostly those pull ups, which he's shooting 50. He's 20 for 40 on pull up threes in this series, which is like, I think we talked about it in our last episode. It was like, it's basically just if Steph can hit insane shots, Golden State has a chance, and he comes out and hits just one insane shot after the next in game four. I was at the game. I had a really interesting angle for a bunch of Steph's threes, particularly the ones in the first half. And there was one when the Warriors were shooting on kind of the side where the media sits. And there was one shot where Derek White trailed over the screen and he had like the best rear contest you can possibly have on a shooter without fouling. Like his hand must have like grazed Curry's hair and Curry drilled it. And it was exactly what you were talking about. It was like, this is, it's like you can't do anything better than that. But the one play that really sticks out to me, ironically, is the one with about a minute to go. When Clay misses a three, the Warriors are up three. Clay misses a three. Draymond grabs the offensive rebound. He kicks it back out to Steph. Derek White is on Steph. Tatum is on Green. Green goes to set a ball screen for Curry. And the Celtics blitz it. I think it was the first time in the game that they blitz Steph. Steph throws it over the top to Draymond. Draymond has a 4-on-3. Patented. That's like their gravy, Golden State Warriors gravy. He hits Kevon Looney on a dump off right under the rim for a layup, and the Warriors go up five. And that play really sticks out to me because for all of their issues offensively that Boston had, like, you really can't, and maybe they were intentionally, let's say, I have a really hard time believing that that was what was supposed to happen on that possession. Normally they would switch it, put White on Draymond and Tatum on Curry, and with the clock winding down, have to have make Curry go against Tatum one-on-one and get a bucket or make a play. And for the Celtics to kind of break down like that defensively, I thought was most telling on up until this point, that was their most important, probably their most important defensive possession of their entire season. So that stuck out to me. Do you know what play I'm talking about?
Oh, completely. Chris? I mean, it was interesting because for all the talk of Draymond and, you know, him being pulled and Kerr putting him back in, you start to see, and this is the sort of thing that you start to talk about Draymond's importance within Golden State's universe, it's easy enough to look at him and say he's not producing, he's not good, he's this, he's that, but he also, like, that's Golden State's offense at its healthiest. What you just described is exactly being able to get for, like, creating disadvantages for the defense where they're having to try to guard four people with three defenders. That you want that obviously the disadvantage for Golden State is that Draymond has not made really anything in this series. The one shot he made in this game was an uncontested putback dunk, I believe, or whatever it was. You know, so he was 0 for 6 aside from that shot. So he hasn't been able to score when he's had a 4-on-3 advantage, but they haven't really been seeing a lot of those because Draymond hasn't even been looking at the basket a lot of the time in this series. So that, giving that up, that's why you were saying, because of the sort of scenario it came in off of an offensive rebound, the defense is scrambling around already because of that. It makes you think that Boston kind of just wasn't prepared for it because it was a weird scramble sort of situation. But yeah, that explains why Kerr wanted Draymond in the game. He can grab an offensive rebound. He's still a good passer. You know, he's going to make mistakes from time to time, but you trust him in that situation about as much as anybody outside of Steph, to at least make the right read, make the right play if it's there. And so, that play was huge. And, you know, there are a couple of plays down the stretch that Draymond made that were pretty important. And, you know, do indicate that Kerr had enough faith to go back to him in some situations, even after pulling him, which I think was really, really important here.
Yeah, I feel like, honestly, if you look at Draymond's stat line from game four, like, it was kind of just like a quintessential Draymond game in a good way. And I understand that he was passing up open looks around the basket, which is not what you want to see. But 5 offensive rebounds, 8 assists, 4 steals, 2 points, not great. Only 3 fouls, only 2 turnovers. I know he was benched in the fourth and he was pretty upset about it. And I was kind of waiting to see with bated breath when or if Kerr would bench Draymond in the series. And we saw it. We're going to talk about this later, but we talked about it in the last pod
that you were basically saying, and I remember I was like, you wouldn't have Draymond in your, you know, in your ideal lineup. And you're like, I mean, it's either him or Looney. And I mean, so clearly Kerr was up against the fence with that same question. He used both of them at times towards the end there. He went long stretches with just one. And I think that kind of, maybe it was a turning point in the series. Maybe it lights a fire under Draymond to be more aggressive. Certainly he's going to be playing back at home now, you know, outside of an environment where people are telling him to F off the whole game. So maybe that helps, you know, maybe. But also, like, if he just can put down a layup or two, you know, it's not that the guy needs to be scoring 15 a game. It's like, can he give you 8? Can he make 3 baskets, instead of 1, instead of nothing? That is a big difference. And even just those few points, any pressure that you can take off of Steph and put on to Boston to have to care about you defensively, that's really important in a series where nobody else has been a consistent, consistent scorer. We've talked about Poole and basically like his 12 points a game throughout the series or whatever it's been. Klay has been a little bit better, obviously. You know, game three was good for him. But, you know, it would still do wonders for Golden State if Draymond could give them like 7-8 points on a given night, and particularly going home for a game five where this series is going to shift one way or the other, would be massive for them. You're right. It wasn't, it was not, by no means was it like a bad Draymond game, because he did so much other stuff in key moments. But the scoring would just, I mean, at that point, you're talking about all-star level Draymond if he could give you even 8 or 9 points. And that's something that they could just, you know, that they win the series, frankly, if they get that sort of production out of him with the way Steph is playing and with the way Steph is having to be defended.
I'm looking at this now. Draymond's usage is lower than Kevon Looney's in this series. Isn't that, that's kind of wild. I did not anticipate that statistic. And I'm yeah. throwing that at you on the fly. That's pretty wild.
No, but we've talked about this a little bit though. That like absolutely. Wasn't it? It was game one, right? That he took 12 shots. Now I was like, that's a huge yeah. win for Boston, particularly if you're only making two of them. But if Draymond's not shooting at all, it's a win for them in some ways too, because then it's one less guy you even have to worry. You don't have to worry about him. So it's there's a sweet spot there, and that's what I'm saying. Is like I think. There's extremes with everything in the playoffs because you only have so many shots until you're like, okay, we got to do away with this guy. We got to put him on the bench, this, that. We can only lose one more game here before we're desperate and we can't play this guy at all. His ideal is probably somewhere around the number of shots he took, but you can't shy away from them if the other team is not defending you. Like you have to take some shots if you're going to be a primary ball handler on this team like Draymond is at times. And so, you know, the end of the game, the situation presented itself with that offensive board where he was that, and he did attack on some level. So we'll see. It'll be really interesting. Like to me, he's the key guy for Golden State that I think when you talk about him having to get it going, it's not necessarily him scoring a lot. It's just him being more aggressive than he's been and not being afraid, quite frankly, which, you talk about Draymond Green, you don't normally think about fear. But mm-hmm. there is some of the Ben Simmons stuff with him, and we've seen it before. We saw it last year too, I think, in their play-in game situation, I remember, against Memphis, I think. So we've seen it. He just has to kind of break out of it somehow, and just even if you're missing a couple of them, you got to shoot them. You got to go after it.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm curious, Chris, while watching this game, were you surprised that Golden State won given, I guess, like, Boston, particularly in the fourth quarter, and there's a narrative coming out of that game that Boston kind of let one slip that they could have had, and they kept mounting these 5-6 point leads and couldn't build on them at all, particularly late in the game, even though their offense wasn't great, and then they stopped hitting shots and they were sped up a little bit. But even with Steph playing as well as he did, like, were you anticipating a Golden State victory? Were you just like watching in the moment? Were you like, were the Celtics just like, what was going through your head, I guess, in the fourth quarter? Like, did you believe that Golden State would win, or did you think that the Celtics kind of were in a position to go up 3-1 and kind of take a firm command of the series?
No, there's no question. So I remember marking this down in light of our, the outline you gave me. Did it feel like there was a moment where that was like definitive that it was going to happen? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel like particularly, Jaylen Brown had that ridiculous scoop layup in transition, at yes. one point about midway through the fourth. That was the moment where I circled it.
Yeah. And one that wasn't an and one. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was the crowd was euphoric. They were, I think that put them up by 4, if I remember. I think it was 90-86. They got a free throw from Smart that put them up 91-86. So they were up 5 with 7 minutes to go. The crowd was as into it as they'd been all night. I'm looking at a website called Unpredictable, which is, you know, it deals with some analytics and some live win probability stuff. It deals with all sorts of kind of cool stuff as it relates to high leverage situations and the most important play of a game, the least valuable player of a game, most valuable player, whatever. It had them at about 83%, with Boston up five, 83% win probability, I should clarify, with about 7 minutes to go. And then not even just that, but even once Golden State closed it a little bit, there was that big three that Marcus Smart hit too.
That's the one I got up, here.
I think. Yeah, like it wasn't, you know, it's weird in hindsight to say that like a 4-point lead over Golden State at any point, even if there's 10 seconds left in the game, like a 4-point lead doesn't feel safe against a team like Golden State. But, you know, there were only a couple minutes left in the game and there was just something about it that just, I think the Smart three came off an offensive rebound. And just kind of like there was something about it that just kind of felt like this might be it. And clearly it wasn't. And I think one person we have to talk about is we talk about Looney and Draymond and their offensive rebounds. Wiggins, man, and talking about the sorts of contributions you could have without scoring. Wiggins scored. It's not as if he wasn't scoring in that game, but 16 rebounds in that mm-hmm. game and a couple huge. Of massive, massive offensive boards that just were huge, including one that he had a putback on. You know, Clay had a couple of really big baskets down the stretch as well. One that he created for himself where it looked like he was going to go to the basket and then kind of did this awkward reverse pirouette fadeaway. And obviously a huge, huge three where, again, Steph dictating everything. The Celtics' two best players come out and guard him and are basically standing in front of him, and Tatum and Brown. Steph sees it and immediately just swings the ball to Clay, who's standing there open at the top of the key to knock in a three that I think gave them the lead. And I think that was the, you know, I think that was yep. basically the end of, not the end of the game, but Golden State didn't relinquish the lead after that. So that made it 95-94. So, I mean, there were moments where it certainly felt like the Celtics had the game and Steph just kind of did what he was doing and taking advantage of the one-on-ones that he had. And when he had situations where it was one-on-two, he swung the ball. And, you know, so everything was dictated by him, but Wiggins had a huge role in it as well. All the offensive rebounds ultimately killed Boston towards the end. I think they had five more in the game than Boston did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wrote about Wiggins after the game. His performance stood out for obvious reasons, and I thought that he was going to be a barometer for the Warriors coming into this series because he can create his own shot. He's their second best defender who plays regular minutes. And in this matchup, he's probably, you can argue, their best defender. I don't think that's, you could make the argument. He's their most indispensable defender. Really their only two-way wing on the team. Like, when he was on the court, they were plus 20. When he sat for like 4 minutes, they were minus 10. I didn't think that was a coincidence at all. And I think Jeff Van Gundy was on the broadcast being like, you need to, when Wiggins sat, he was like, yeah, you got to get Wiggins back in this game immediately. And I totally agree with that. He was huge. Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned the Marcus Smart three felt like one of those, like, just like a destiny shot. Like,
yeah,
had no business going in, put them up four with like, I don't even know, 5 minutes to go.
It didn't look like a comfortable shot was part of why it felt like one of those destiny ones where it was like he kind of shot it maybe a split second earlier than I thought. It looked like he was unsure about whether he had the amount of space he wanted to take the shot. So it went in. I mean, again, the crowd was just going nuts because this is really an opportunity to put the series away, really, is kind of what that felt like, that game, if they win it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the series would have been over. Yeah, and I have not thought, like, that was when that shot went in, that was the first time in the whole postseason run where I was like, okay, the Celtics are going to win the championship. Like, I thought that they should win the championship, but after that shot went in, I was like, okay, they should coast down the stretch here. That was an absolutely insane make by Marcus Smart. I do feel like it wasn't, like, I feel like that loss, Game 4's loss, wasn't quite as big of a gut punch for the Celtics as Game 5 of the second round when Bobby Portis had the putback and then they go down 3-2.
Yeah.
I also think that Jimmy Butler's Game 6, 47 points in the Garden, when everyone for days is saying that the Miami Heat are kind of dead and buried, that loss, like, most teams could not come back, I feel like, from a game four loss like Boston had in these finals, given the lead and how close they were. It's just like so tantalizing against a team like the Warriors that you can't give so many opportunities to. But what makes this Celtics team so fascinating is their resiliency. And it's just, this series is just, it's shaping up to be a classic. And I really hope it goes seven. It's incredible stuff. One of the reasons why it's a classic is Steph Curry, who finished with 43 points, 7 for 14 behind the three-point line. My question to you is this was this the best game of Steph's career, in your opinion?
Probably. And, you know, my response would be if it wasn't, then it's extremely, extremely close. I mean, the first thing I think most people are at least going to look at, if they can't remember from memory, is, you know, like, how many times has he scored more than this? And so, mm-hmm. You know, one of them was before he was even in his title run. I think it was 2013 against the Spurs, and I think the semifinal round, if I remember correctly, in the Western semis. So when you're looking at the title era that they've had in Golden State, he's only had one game where there was more than this, more scoring than this. And I think there's an argument to be made. Now, the ending was very different. The game was not single digits by the end. And they held him down at the very end because, probably for a couple of reasons. One, I'm sure dude was tired. But two, he was playing without Clay and KD, who were hurt at that point. So, you know, it's like having to weigh it, the two things against that. Do you value the performance where he has literally no one else? And is just doing what he can. And keep in mind, that was a series where Nick Nurse was throwing literally everything he could. And Steph had already thrown a box and one at the guy earlier in the series. And then it was open season to do stuff like that when you were playing without Clay and without Kevin Durant, who was hurt. So, you know, the interesting thing about that game, I think, is that, again, and you and I have had this conversation before where I think we both compared this Boston defense and we're raising the question about whether this was the best defense that Giannis had played and having to play Boston. And I think both of us said it might be, but Toronto was really damn good too. Even guys on that team that we didn't necessarily think of as like elite defenders have since kind of become players that we at least include in that conversation, like a Fred VanVleet. And lo and behold, you know, Fred VanVleet started to get that reputation after the way he defended Steph. So this was really impressive. I mean, the point total, 47, 43, with the stakes being this high. And again, this being a win, him coming through big in the fourth quarter versus not having done that in the game against and the game against Toronto. I think you could say that this was, like I said, if not, then it was very, very close. But I think you could make the argument very clearly that it might have been.
It's hard for me to say it wasn't the best. Like, the Raptors game, very impressive, obviously. One thing I look at is, like, he was 31 in that Raptors game. He's that 34 too. Now.
Like, banged up in this game, too, a little bit.
Coming off the weird foot thing, exactly. Stakes down 2-1 on the road, could go down 3-1. The opponent, like, all due respect to that Raptors defense, I give a slight edge to the Celtics defense, the slightest of edges. The environment, the fact that it's the finals, I think he's surrounded by less offensive talent than he's ever had right now. And the way he's being guarded is kind of reflecting that reality. Just like, even when he's like, he hit this floater over, like, from the right elbow in the fourth quarter. It was just like,
yeah,
he made, it's one of the hardest shots in the game, and he looked made easy. It look so easy. So I think it was the best, and I was, like, so lucky enough to sit there and watch it in person, and to see his emotion also was very telling from the jump. when the first I think it was after the first TV timeout heading into it, he hit this just ridiculous pull-up three over Al Horford. Actually, it was over Jaylen Brown, but they had Al Horford in the coverage. And it was like, hits this shot, it's like probably a 32-footer, and then just walks towards the Celtics crowd and starts barking at them. And from where I was sitting, it felt like he was kind of barking at, like, not us too, but like, he was in the general vicinity and I was getting intimidated and I'm not even playing in the basketball game. And he's terrifying. Which kind of brings me to my next question, Chris. Where do you rank Steph Curry on the list of just the greatest players you've seen live in your lifetime? That could be on TV, that could be in person, but since you've been on this earth, where does he rank? In terms of, I mean, historically is a totally different conversation, and we're going to probably revisit that, I would say, in the off season.
Maybe in the next week or so, yeah.
Probably. But just since you've, all the players you've been able to see and witness, just where does he rank? And I know it's really, it's hard to kind of not stay in the moment with a game like this, and I probably am a victim of it, but... For you, what's the answer to that question?
Yeah, well, thank you for clarifying kind of the question a little bit, because my first thing on my list here was like, ask Michael, when does my lifetime start? Which feels like more a question for my mom and dad, or just my birth certificate. But, you know, if you're saying as a cognizant watcher of the game and of the sport, which for me, even though I'm from Chicago and I'm 35, like Michael Jordan... was really the very beginning of that, but I didn't even catch the majority of his career as like someone that could absorb what he was doing. I think both of us might have been a little bit too young to have done that. So, you know, still assuming that, you know, people are not pulling my leg, I saw how dominant he was when I watched him, and that was, you know, the last 2 years of his time with the Bulls, really. I would honestly say that Steph is probably fourth, which feels kind of unfair to say that. Fourth, maybe even fifth. Michael, I would say, has to be number one or at least very close to that. LeBron, okay. I feel like, is understandably going to be either one or two. So those two, I think, are kind of shoe-ins. The guy that I have in front of him that I think it's fair to have him in front for now is Tim Duncan. Now, I did not see necessarily as much of his prime by the time I started covering the league, but the guy was still clearly a huge difference maker even towards the back end of his career. You know, and maybe the type of play that he had, the style of play that he had, was one that wasn't as hindered by the idea of being older. But, you know, like, it's pretty rare that we're able to look at bigs and be able to say that they can really hold their own. You know, so I would put him there at number three. I think also just the fact that, you know, we talk about Steph and, you know, even Howard Beck and other people have taken full notice of or have written about the impact that he has aside from just Steph's shooting. And Steph is a better defender than he gets credit for. And we've seen it even in moments in the series. He's also never going to be confused with being like an elite defender the way that Tim Duncan was. So I don't think that you can look at the beautiful kind of two-way balance that Tim Duncan had for so long and say that Steph deserves to be over him right now. Maybe over time. I might even have a hard time with that, but maybe over time. But I would say Duncan's two-way stuff, I would put him over Steph. Where I have Steph is like, okay, him or Shaq. And maybe I'd give a slight edge to Curry. Shaq was not a dominant defensive player. Shaq was someone that was dominant kind of in the inverse way to Steph. So I think it's an interesting conversation to be had there. But, you know, so I would probably put Steph somewhere fourth or fifth. I'm not sure. I haven't given it a whole lot of thought, but that's where I would have him. I would have him after those first three, certainly. MJ, LeBron, and Tim Duncan.
So I have MJ, LeBron, for sure. Those are two in front of it. And then Duncan is fascinating, and I think when Curry retires, there are going to be so many parallels with Steph and Tim Duncan, like as figures,
the leadership,
like all-time teammates. their personas that aren't like very, you know, rah-rah. They don't wear their emotions on their sleeve typically when they're playing. They're just so steady. The Steve Kerr connection. Kerr has compared the two many times. For me, this is me being caught in the moment. I'm putting Steph 3 for me.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Slightly ahead of Tim Duncan. I'm glad that you mentioned Tim Duncan and did not overlook him because he's one of the 10 greatest players who ever lived. And I'll probably waffle back on this in a week if Steph has like two duds for the rest of the series.
It helps that he hasn't had one yet this series, which exactly. I will say this. It's a little bit early. You know what? Actually, I'll leave it alone because let me stick with your outline. Go ahead. Keep going.
Okay. So I guess the other players who popped into my head after looking it up, like mm-hmm. I would put Steph ahead of Hakeem Olajuwon. I would put Steph ahead of Kobe Bryant. That's going to probably make people upset, but I don't think it's particularly close to me. I put him ahead of Shaq. Kevin Durant is one name we haven't mentioned.
And he was on my list too, yeah.
It's very close. I'm going Steph over KD. There's just something about the ability to cross half court and instantly the other team is in danger that none of these other players can replicate. And he's so unique and so like powerful in his own way, dominant in his own way, which was the whole thesis of Howard's wonderful story about him coming into the series.
There's something to be said too, if Steph ends up having as many titles without KD as KD has with Steph, like it's just, no, I know that rings are not everything, but it just gets a little bit difficult to say that KD was a greater player all time when he played with them. I think benefited from playing with Steph. And obviously Steph benefited from playing with him too. So I'm not trying to, it's not all or nothing, but I just kind of feel like, man, like that is a form of greatness too, to be able to be the spearhead of two teams that win a championship. So if he gets this one, this would give him 4. 2 that came with KD, 2 that didn't. But you're talking about at that point, how many years would that have been? It would have been 7 years between titles that he won without KD. The last one they won without KD 2015 was 2015.
To 2022,
that's pretty impressive, man. Like that also speaks to the longevity that you were talking about, like the difference between Steph's career high in the playoffs at 31 versus now. Is fundamentally different. So I look, man, you're not gonna have to shout me down or argue with me to say that Steph, you know, as of right now, you know, is kind of higher up on that list than KD. Maybe, like you said, maybe we're prisoners in the moment, but this feels different. And I mean, I'm still stunned by a lot of things in this series, but the idea that as Tatum struggles, as Brown has moments where maybe he's not sure of where he's going with the ball or whatever, maybe he struggles a little bit for a quarter or two. Like Steph really hasn't had that. Maybe, you know, a quarter where he doesn't play well, but the numbers speak for themselves. And I mean, the eye test is even more affirming, I think, than the numbers most of the time.
Yeah. And there's also just in the particular Durant versus Curry conversation, there's the fact that Kevin Durant's team also played against the Boston Celtics and were swept, and Kevin Durant struggled mightily in that series. And, you know, a lot of reasons for the Nets being totally dysfunctional. I'm not blaming Kevin Durant for that, but on a pure talent basis, like he had Kyrie Irving as a teammate. I can't even remember who's on the who's in that Nets series, to be honest, now that I'm thinking back on it. Feels like it was 25 years ago. Yeah, Bruce Brown was like the third best player, so that kind of invalidates my argument. But yeah, it's fascinating to see the Curry have this level of success against a defense like this. He's like breaking a defense that it didn't like dominate Durant, it didn't dominate Giannis or Jimmy Butler, but it dictated a lot of what they wanted to do, and it made their life really difficult from a physical perspective, and they can't really do that with Steph, or haven't been able to so far because of the shooting. So I just think he's such a special player, and he ranks so high in my estimation right now. So I want to ask you a question, one last question about Game 4, and then we'll look ahead to tonight's Game 5. Draymond Green obviously gets benched with about 8 minutes to go in the fourth quarter. We mentioned that already. I never thought it would actually happen because of who Draymond is and what he's meant to the Golden State Warriors throughout this entire run. Do you think, like, what do you think would have happened if the Warriors lost that game? Kerr benches Draymond. I know he brings him back for the offense-defense substitutions with Jordan Poole with about 3 minutes to go. But if they lost that game, what is the fallout for the Warriors? Like, it could have gotten to we have to trade Draymond level if they lost the series then in five. Like, I don't know. It would have been catastrophic. Am I being a little hyperbolic here?
So for us as observers, I don't think anything shifts because coaches generally do what they think is best. Steve Kerr's not making that move just to do it. He's not doing it just as a move. He's doing it because he thinks that gives him the best chance to win. Yep. Draymond claims that he understands that part. Doesn't mean he liked it. But like you said, the practical part of you as a player is going to say whatever it takes to win. And they won. If they lose, which that's the crux of your question, man, I would have been interesting to hear Draymond's response in that situation. It would have been fascinating to have heard it.
Would have been an all-time press conference.
And an all-time podcast from Draymond. the thing is, but normally when you look at benchings that are really controversial, it's because it's like, why are they not out there? The DeAndre Ayton thing. Would anybody have been asking the question, why is Draymond not out there with the way he was playing offense? Really? I mean, we all understood it. You were asking about it days before the day of the game, before the game. Like, that's the move that you thought should have been made. So it doesn't mean it's not stunning sometimes to watch it. But I do think when you're talking about a defense that's this good, you have to make changes like that. And there are times where Draymond's skill set, particularly if he's playing next to another big that can't space the floor, you're going to have moments where that, or even when you're playing like Iguodala or other guys like that, like, you're going to have moments where you're just a little bit cramped. Even moments where it's like, I feel like sometimes these handoffs and Porter and Klay Thompson, they've got moments where they look cramped, where there's just like not a lot of space, or it's like they're doing the defense a favor by how close they're standing to each other. So I would have understood it. For me, just looking at it, it would have been silly to make a big deal out of it if you're Draymond, because, quite frankly, they don't look right all the time when he's out there. But for their sake, for Steve's sake, thank goodness they won the game. And you don't have those questions if Draymond is who he says he is and prioritizes what he says he does. And I imagine that he does. They won the game, so there's no need to worry about it. You go out, play better, it's not an issue. But, like I said, if you can give them a couple of baskets, it's not a question because we know the other stuff he brings to the table. But going back and watching that game, there were a lot of sequences where Draymond really didn't look like he was in the best position defensively on some of the shots that they were allowing. So if he's not a huge, huge plus on that side, he's literally not making any baskets on the offensive side. Yes, he moves the ball on offense, but he also cramps your spacing. So I understood why I wasn't out there. You understood why I wasn't out there. You were saying you thought it would be more effective for them if he wasn't out there. So it wasn't surprising. It would have just been like, can Draymond look in the mirror and realize why he's benched? That's the question that I don't know that we're able to answer because of the way the game played out. They won. If they lose tonight and it's the same sort of thing, and then they lose the series because it's the same sort of thing, then maybe it becomes an off-season question. But I don't think that they would change that much because of one series. It would be a very important series. Mm-hmm. and maybe it would tell teams a little bit more about how to go about defending them. But Boston can do things that a lot of other defenses can't. So
much easier.
I don't think it's a huge, yeah, I don't think it's a huge thing, but it does tell you about, you know, Draymond's limitations. And I think this is a team that has kind of put those to the test fully.
All right. I want to look ahead to game five now and get back to the Curry conversation. Much has been made about, and including on this podcast, about how the Celtics have defended Curry in the pick and rolls. And the pick and roll count with Curry has been kind of rising game by game by game, because it is just evident that the Warriors can't get anything cooking off ball. There's no... the split actions, they just switch everything, the back cuts, all of the wonderful elements that make the Warriors the Warriors. Boston's done a terrific job taking a lot of those actions away. And it's left them in the half court in particular to attack with Curry in the pick and roll. Boston has dropped 50% of the time in the pick and roll. And Curry has, for the most part, roasted the drop. Do you agree with Ime Udoka's game plan? Do you agree with Ime Udoka's confidence in his game plan? It is clear he is not going to change it. For the record, I just want to say on the record, I 100% agree with what he's doing. I understand it fully. I don't think it's controversial because of everything I just said about how they're taking everything else away, and not letting the Warriors be the Warriors. And the Warriors' offense is not, you know, it's very good with Steph on the floor. Overall, it's not that great, to be honest. Their offensive rating is like 110, I think, in the series. What do you think about the coverages that they're deploying against Curry? Should they switch more? Should they blitz? I hate asking that question. I just think it's so stupid. But should they blitz? Should they continue to drop as much as they are? Just what do you make of how they're trying to contain this guy who's so far been uncontainable?
So I am of the opinion that for me, the thing that actually scared me most about the way they were defending was when Steph said, okay, now you guys are coming up all the way and I'm just going to dribble around you or shake you and get into inside the arc and I'm comfortable enough with the mid-range. Like, at that point, I would rather entice him into shooting threes, maybe not taking away all his airspace, but most of it. Like, I think the problem was for the first few games, particularly that was like the thing we were seeing in the first and the third quarters, is like they would do so well in the second quarter of the Celtics, and then it was like they would almost forget you still have to come up kind of high to stop the guy from shooting. And so he would just go bonkers in the third, which is part of what we've seen throughout the series. You want him to feel like he can pull up but not just go directly around you. And so that to me, maybe, I don't know, maybe there's something to be said for like, let him have the two, don't give him the three. I didn't like him getting so comfortable from inside the arc. He also is a pretty decent finisher in the series too, if you let him get all the way to the basket. So I'm probably like the way that the teams have been playing, the way the Celtics have been playing, certainly the way that the Warriors were playing at the beginning of the series, where they would have an additional defender behind the guy that's actually stopping the ball. And, you know, the way that they've had Draymond playing throughout the series, maybe you bring somebody up to make sure that Steph can't get what he wants from the mid-range. If you bring someone up really high, you've got to have somebody there that's ready to step up to at least contest him so that it's not an easy look for him. Like you were saying before about the rear view contest with Derek White, maybe there's a way to do more of that. You can live with some of the makes that Steph had that were just really, really difficult. So because of that, I don't think I'm willing to change a whole lot about what I'm doing. I just think some of the mid-range makes, like you said, the floater was like, goodness, who makes this shot? But some of the other ones just looked a little bit too comfortable to me. And I think as long as you could tighten up some of that he gets when he's going toward the basket, I think that you could actually stay the same. What you don't want is Draymond and Wiggins and Clay and for Poole to have a 28-point game all of a sudden. Like, you don't right. want everybody else going off. You've kept yourself within striking distance of being able to win pretty much all these games. I would say I didn't agree with Ime saying that at least 3-1. I don't think that they were going to win game two. I didn't really see that in the making. They were fortunate to get game one with the way they shot. So, you know, they 3-1 would have been nice, and that maybe was attainable, but they were never going to sweep the series. But yeah, like you said, their offense, if their offense had been good enough, they could have won three of these games. And that should give you some comfort in saying we can stick with this. At some point, maybe you just think Steph will be off. And if that's the case, Golden State has their back against the wall and having to try to protect the series. So I think they can stay with most of what they're doing. I just think they could be a little bit tighter inside the arc a little bit every now and then.
Yeah, I think it's, like I said, I think that there are different shades of quote-unquote drop coverage. You don't want to have your feet as the big below the three-point line with Steph. If he gets the 25-footer pull up clean, then he's going to make that like a layup. I think they've done a pretty good job executing what they want to do, and I think that it's the right game plan in the aggregate, and it puts a lot of pressure on whoever's on him, be it Derek White, be it Marcus Smart, be it Tatum or Jaylen, after an initial switch, to either go under and recover, which is really hard, but Ime has said that he actually likes how they've executed in those situations, or fight over the top and then recover also, which is very difficult. But you're not the best defense in the NBA by accident. And I think that their execution on the whole, besides the first quarter of game one, which, you know, when we'd say 20 for 40 on pull-up threes, we're including the first quarter of game one when he went absolutely bananas. I think on the whole, that strategy has held up. And when you look at the issues that Boston has had, I don't think it's defensively. I think it is, if you look at, you know, process versus results, your process is good. The results have not really worked in your favor just because Steph has made so many really tough shots. Klay Thompson has hit some tough, tough shots. I know these are the two greatest shooters who have ever lived, but the way that they've hit these shots is like, if you are an opposing head coach and you have belief in your defense, you don't necessarily think that some of these looks are sustainable. So that's why it's a 7-game series and you're going to ride it out. And I think Ime should. And I don't think it's that controversial. And the only possession that really bothered me watching it was the blitz. I think they've only blitzed Steph 3 times in the entire series. That was one of them. Biggest possession of the game for them defensively. They couldn't get a stop. Letting others get involved is a death sentence against the Warriors. And limiting their assist rate, which they've done, which I wrote about on our roundtable on SI.com that everyone can check out, previewing game 5. I think the assist disparity is very fascinating still. And Golden State led the NBA during the regular season with 66.9% assist rate. They're at 59.1, I believe, off the top of my head in the series. That's significant. It speaks to Boston taking Golden State out of their comfort zone. So I think the defensive coverage is fine. It's all about execution, which they've done a pretty good job of so far. They just need to keep it up 2 more times out of 3 games and get the offense right. Speaking of the offense, Jason Tatum, we have not mentioned Jason Tatum yet in this episode, which is very interesting. What do you make of his struggles? Are they overblown because he's shooting like 24% inside the arc in the series, missing a lot of layups, missing a lot of the tough ISO pull-ups that I'm not going to say he's DeMar DeRozan, but shots that he can typically hit over someone like Jordan Poole and needs to hit over Curry, over Poole. What have you made of Tatum's series so far? And is it more something that he's not doing or something Golden State is doing to kind of make life very difficult for him?
It's a little bit of both. I think what I can respect about him but don't love is that he takes the tough shots. When he's playing at his best, he makes those. I mean, we talk about all the stuff he wears, the, you know, kind of honoring, paying homage to Kobe. He's got a lot of that to his game, which is good, bad. It's not always a great thing. It's not always a horrible thing. The real thing, I mean, I think it's simple enough, and this is why I would say Golden State has something to do with the way he's playing. Look at the four games so far. Game one for him. Just take out his scoring aspect. Don't even look at that. 13 assists versus 2 turnovers in game one. 3 assists versus 4 turnovers in game two. 9 assists versus 2 turnovers in game three. 6 assists versus 6 turnovers in game four. That actually tells you a lot of the story right there. Golden State is doing something to influence the turnovers. They certainly made it a lot more difficult on him and made a point to do that in game two, which we talked about after game one, of the idea of, man, like, you could probably afford to loosen up on Tatum a little bit to make sure that he doesn't get everybody else going. So they've done that at times, but I think they've struck the balance, Golden State's defense, and kind of finding out how do we make it difficult on him, particularly from mid-range, while also not just letting him have a field day as far as the passing is concerned. So that's the part that's tightened up for him, and that's kind of what he has to figure out. I trust him to figure it out from a scoring standpoint, but if the threes are all he's comfortable with and all he's getting comfortably, maybe it means reducing the mid-range stuff if it's not falling for him. Some of those shots are just so difficult. And if you could move the ball around and find somebody else who's open, or if it's an extra couple passes and you've got the time on the shot clock to do it, that could be an answer. Like, I think part of what Boston needs anyway is a couple more guys to get going. I know that's something we were going to talk about, is like, who do you feel like is capable of doing more? I feel like it's a good thing when you're mentioning Grant Williams a lot when he's doing more. I feel like it's a good thing when you're talking about someone like Al Horford being a little bit more involved. You can look at the same sorts of splits for them, as far as maybe not, you know, as clear as the assist totals for Tatum, but, you know, just how involved was Al Horford? I think the games in which he's had single digits in this series, they've lost. The games in which he's had double digits, they've won. Grant Williams, you know, the best game of the series, they won. The other games where he had basically been absent, like, they've, you know, they've been more marginal. So I think that there's a lot to be said here, but I think Tatum just can't turn the ball over the way he's doing, or he can't have an ugly assist turnover ratio. I think they could actually survive him shooting somewhat poorly as long as he's not turning the ball over too, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. We did one of our roundtable questions, wasn't it, like, who's like the second most likely to win finals MVP or the second best player in the series? I forget the exact question.
Yeah.
And I had Tatum as my answer. I think that Jaylen Brown has a strong case, absolutely. The efficiency is not there for Tatum. But when you add just the context of how he's being defended, like, they're not guarding anyone like they're guarding Tatum. And I'm talking about the Warriors. Like, they don't guard they guard Jaylen basically straight up with, especially in the fourth quarter, they guarded him straight up with Clay. Clay was incredible on ball, like, turning him, forcing tough contests. It was like peak Clay Thompson defense, something that it's like unimaginable to think about when you think about where he was 2-3 months ago on the court. So you got to tip your cap there, but, like, they don't really guard Tatum one-on-one. And when they do, and he gets to the rim, he typically has success finishing, but they load up behind the ball, they blitz him. There's always at least two sets of eyes on him. And to your point, like, he can't drive into the crowd, drive into the help, and then try to make a pass, try to draw the foul, turn it over, live ball. Like, that's when he's at his worst. And I thought he's been overall a pretty good decision maker against the second best defense in the NBA one of the smartest defenses in the NBA, that is executing their game plan to stop him as well as they have. So the shooting, it really isn't, I don't, he's also making 45% of his threes.
Yeah. Which is kind of a big deal. Yeah. It's just the 2-point stuff really, but the tough shots. His threes have generally been pretty open shots, which comes from them moving the ball, which gets back to what we were saying before about the idea of if you don't have it or if you don't have a great look and there's enough time on the clock, move the ball. You might get it back anyway.
Yeah, he's also evolved relocating off the ball. He's not Steph Curry, but he's also not Trae Young. Like, he relocates when he gives it up, and he's really improved that area of his game. So I think the Celtics would love a offensive explosion from Jason Tatum in Game 5 and Game 6, and if it goes 7, they'd love for him to do what he did in Game 6 of the second round, absolutely. But you'll take the patience, the good decisions, the trust in the teammates. I think that that's what makes you a superstar, knowing where everybody else is on the floor, elevating everybody else. And in their wins, he's done a really good job of that. So that's why I picked Tatum to be the, I guess, I don't even know what the question was, like finals, second best finals MVP likelihood.
I mean, on some level, we've reached a point now where it's like, if Boston wins the series, who wins MVP? It's not so much like who's the second choice. It's more, we know who's going to win it if Golden State wins. The interesting question, I think, sort of becomes, and without trying to be too cute, and I know Howard wrote the story kind of looking back at the 2016 finals and the question.
It's not cute. It's not cute.
I mean, at this point, Steph has had the most points in every game so far. And we can very clearly look at everything that he's impacting, even when he's not the one that takes the shot. Steph could realistically win finals MVP, particularly if the series goes 7 and Golden State loses. I think it's a very fair question. Tatum has scored enough, but he hasn't done it the most efficiently on his team. He's averaging the same amount of points as Brown. So Brown could win it, you know, and if the efficiency is a problem for some voters, Brown could win it. But Steph has played the best clearly of anybody on either team, and it's not even really that close. So, I mean, you know, maybe some people think it's inside baseball to think about that. You know, it's probably not that academic of a question. At this point, it's more a question of, can Steph keep doing this? And if he does, it maybe becomes academic in the sense that Golden State is going to win the series anyway, particularly if Tatum doesn't perform better or doesn't take better care of the ball. So it's all fascinating. It's a kind of a grouping of things that we haven't seen before. We haven't seen Steph be this consistently great before in the finals. We generally have not seen Tatum struggle efficiency wise for this long in a series, and something's gonna have to give, and we'll see what it is.
Two predictions from you, and then we'll get out of here. The first, who do you think is gonna win finals MVP?
I think Steph at this point is the clearest bet to do it. I'm starting to think seriously about the idea that he might win it anyway, regardless of how the series plays out. That you know, if Tatum has a massive game or Brown has a massive game and then Boston wins the series, a massive game 6 or a massive game 7, I kind of think it'll tilt in that direction, that, you know, that'll kind of overshadow what happened in the first 5 or 6 games of the series. But again, if the easiest answer here is Steph, just because there's not a debate about who would win it within his team. Whereas with Boston, I think you could debate it. You were saying that, for instance, you thought Tatum should kind of has been the second best player in the series or second most important player in the series. So, you know, since there's that debate, I'll say Steph, even though I'm not sure I would say that I think Golden State won the series. I'm not sure yet about that, but Steph could win it either way. So I'll say him, because I think it's a safer answer.
Who's the fourth most likely player to win finals MVP? Ooh.
Goodness,
that's such a that's a toss up. I have no idea what the answer to that question is.
Wiggins.
Is there a fourth most?
I don't know that there's a fourth, man, because Clay has had some duds in the series. Poole has been a dude. Like, he's just been a dude. Wiggins,
Wiggins winning know. Finals like,
is
MVP.
There a
would
is there a third Celtic we can pick? Like, because I just, yeah, it's not, it's quiet.
Okay. The one Celtic I'd say, and I think that this is borderline impossible, right. is Rob Williams.
He's been
And
great.
I say that because if he were to, he's just the most distinct, like, barometer, for lack of a better word, for Boston. When he's on the floor, their defense is just like, and he's playing well, it's like you can't score against this team. So if he suddenly looked like the pre-surgery Rob Williams for the rest of this series, miraculously, and Boston's defense clamped down, maybe he had like a bunch of lob dunks and offensive putbacks and stuff, like got a couple double doubles, maybe, but no, it's going to be one of those three, Tatum, Brown, or Steph, I think.
For sure. What do you think as far as who it'll be?
I think it's going to be Tatum, is what I think.
Okay.
I don't know if that's the smartest bet, but it leads me into my next and last question to you, Chris, which is who is winning game five tonight?
I do think Boston will get this one. Both, just because it's, you know, as up until this round, we had that stat going with Tatum where every time he shoots worse than this, he shoots at least this well the next game. So there's that part that, you know, something has to give there. You keep thinking that the fact that the series has seesawed as far as, you know, whoever wins one game, the other team wins the next. I don't know. I'm going to pick Boston. I'll probably be wrong just because I feel like I have been a lot lately. But, you know, I am really, really, really curious more than anything else to see what does Draymond look like? Like, there have been a couple factors now that should have lit a fire under this dude's ass between the heckling in Boston and the fact that he was pulled. The fact that really seemed to bother him. The response has to be, aside from your next podcast episode, play better. I feel like a TNT analyst now, an inside the NBA analyst now, but I mean, it's the truth. And he did a lot of Draymond stuff in that game, but you have to expect a little bit more from him just as a scorer at some point to be able to put down better than 1 out of 7 in a game at some point. So we'll see. But that's really what I'm curious to see. And if that happens, then Golden State will win. But I'll pick Boston for tonight, game five.
I am also picking Boston. Yeah, I just think if they don't turn the ball over, they're better, and they have not lost coming off a loss, not lost two games in a row this entire playoff run. I don't think that starts now. So that is who I'm going with. Can't wait to see what happens. Should be great. I really hope this series, we get more close competitive games and not any more blowouts. That would be terrific. Game four was a classic. Hopefully game five is the same thing. I think that'll do it for today, Chris. Thank you so much for your insight, your expertise. Thank you so much to our listeners. Again, I apologize. We didn't have any emails today on the show. There's just so much final stuff to kind of sift through. You know, send some in about the finals. We're getting, I'm not being critical of our wonderful listeners here. We're getting some random questions that have nothing to do with the NBA finals right now. And I'm like, we can't read these we're holding them for the off season. Would love to read some questions on the air. So please get some in. Openfloormail@gmail.com. That's openfloormail@gmail.com. Everybody stay safe. Everybody please enjoy the rest of the NBA finals. Hey.
Fall's here, and so are incredible sales at Tanger Outlets. Find must-have handbags, footwear, and all the latest fall arrivals, all at unbeatable savings. Shop top brands like Nike Factory, Crocs, J. Crew Factory, Coach, Gap Factory, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, and even more brands you love. Save more every time you shop with deals up to 70% off. Tanger Outlets, always on trend, always on sale. Plan your trip at tanger.com.